I want to thank Bill Breitbart so much for being here today. I've had the pleasure of knowing Bill for a number of years and working with him and being taught by him. I've invited Bill with one really specific purpose in mind. And I want him to discuss some of the origins of psycho-oncology. And I hope that we'll move to a discussion about meaning-centered therapy, which is a form of therapy that we use in psycho-oncology frequently, that Bill helped to create. But my real motivation in bringing Bill here on to discuss with me is to sort of understand how you work with patients who are facing mortality. Of course, we see many patients who are distressed. They're not all worried about death, but many, many are. They tend to have many layers of concern, right? So the core concern generally is mortality. And oncologists tend to see the other side when patients are striving for life, and they may or may not be interested in bringing up mortality or considering mortality, but it always comes up, right? As oncologists, we struggle to bring it up. We struggle when to bring it up, and we struggle with how to bring it up. I know through working with Bill and other psycho-oncologists that the answer always depends. This type of learning is truly experiential, and there's not a singular answer necessarily, but I'm hoping that we might distill the key issues and components that go into effectively reaching patients on this topic. That is truly the essence of MCP, meaning-centered therapy, I think. Of course, most oncologists have a tremendous repertoire of experience to draw from when seeing patients who are encountering mortality, but may not have had or received guidance on their approach. Sort of like the old saying that practice doesn't make perfect, but perfect practice does. Of course, there's really no such thing as perfection here, but there is a sort of good enough phenomenon where one reaches a feeling of being competent. To me, this means being ready to discuss it whenever the patient is and not missing that window of opportunity. One of the issues is that we can tend to overcorrect sometimes. Many patients these days get the message that the teams want them to be prepared, but constantly bringing it up can have an off-putting effect, sort of like treating them as if they've already succumbed to the disease. Patients want more than anything an acknowledgement of their presence and existence. How, Bill, do we do this delicate dance? So I've worked with Bill on the wards, and it's a pleasure, and I wish everyone had had that experience, but this will come in close second, hopefully. So let's say that we're on the wards right now, and me as a fellow, I just went in to see a patient. I come out and I present the case to you. And I'm actually thinking of a real case that I saw at Memorial Sloan Kettering. And I went out to my attending and I said, they consulted us for depression, but I don't think this patient is depressed. And my attending at the time said, well, Daniel, look in the chart, see how many times this patient has seen the oncologist. And of course, it was many, 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 many times. Let's say that because the patient's dying, I was a bit shaken up by the experience. What would you say to me, Bill? How would you guide me on working with this patient?
I would probably actually go in and see the patient with you, and I would try to do to engage the patient in a discussion with you present and kind of show you how to do things, And it kind of boils down to a couple of very basic, simple things. One of the things that is really critical in for both oncologists and for psycho-oncologists is that what we try to do in every encounter is have a human conversation, a basic human conversation. And what do I mean by that? I mean that through either the way we convey ourselves, what we might ask about, what we might start, how we might start engaging in things, want to convey the way we sit, the way we stand, the way we, the nonverbal and verbal cues that are given. What we want to do is to convey the message that you and I, patient and a physician, you and I, we're both human beings. We're both in the same existential boat. We're both mortal. We both have the same existential concerns. And the only difference between you and me is time and knowledge. It's your time to be sitting in the, it's being in the bed or in the hospital or sitting across from the oncologist. My time will probably come at some point. And knowledge, you know what it is that is threatening your mortality in a more immediate kind of sense. You can actually see what might get you, right? What might result in mortality. I may not have that knowledge yet. But I have some knowledge about cancer and treatment, either medical oncology knowledge, psychiatric psychology knowledge. I have some knowledge that maybe has helped you, right? And so the first thing is to start to establish and engage in a human conversation. And once you're
Bill, you're saying that as the oncologist, you have that knowledge. You're helping. You're essentially, we're two human beings sitting together, facing mortality, essentially.
right, we're both. There's not much difference between us in terms of the fact that we're both mortal, and so we have this in common. And so for us to be able to talk about existential concern, mortality is not unreasonable. You have them, I have them too, so we can talk about them. Of course, there's this, there are boundaries in terms of how much you want to reveal, about things, about yourself and all that. But it's perfectly okay to be somewhat revealing in the sense of, I worry about dying too, or I have concerns about, I think about death as well, and that. So you said it in your introduction. I think as an oncologist, you don't necessarily want to push the conversation of death and dying and how you're feeling about that. How do you feel about the fact that you're dying? I think you want to open the door. You want the door to be open for the patient to feel welcome about talking about their fears. So an oncologist might say something like, many people with cancer, when they hear the word cancer, they get frightened. They think immediately of death or dying. And I'm sure that's on your mind. And I'm more than glad to talk about that if you want. I know you're here to talk about how we should treat this, right? And what can we do? How can we keep you healthy? How can we do that? What I would probably do when you and I walk in the room is I would actually, after trying to get to know the person as a person a little bit, I'd ask them about their family and what they do for a living and whether they watch Jeopardy or things like that, and then start to talk to them about real serious stuff. I might ask them directly, are you frightened of dying? Do you think about death? Things like that. And I might go straight forward because, it's a territory that I'm very natural in, feel very natural and I'm not concerned about. And it's not my responsibility to keep them alive as a as or to and the expectation on the part of the patient is not to be the person who's going to perform the miracle and keep them alive. We're all kind of dealing with uncertain futures, right? And patients with cancer, cancer that may be even advanced, we're all dealing with some kind of uncertain future, right? We don't know what's going to happen. And a really favorite philosopher of mine, a guy named Jacques Derrida, talked about two kinds of future, the certain future and the uncertain future. And the certain future he described as being universal, mundane, mediocre, completely non-unique. Everybody has the same certain future. You're born, you live and die. There's nothing you can do about it. The fact of the matter is we're all living pretty much uncertain futures. We don't know exactly what's going to happen. There's a course that lays it out. We don't know exactly how long, what are the treatments that are supposed would be most helpful, what steps to take, where to get my care, who to get, trust myself, my care to, do I take this treatment or that treatment, what happens after, how long will I live? I really don't know for sure. The average is this or that, but maybe I exceed the average, maybe I don't. I will die. How will I die? Well, how do I want to spend my time and all that? So the uncertain future really is the only kind of future in which there's a leeway, there's room. The uncertain future is the only kind of future in which you have the possibility of participating in creating that future through the choices that you make. And I have this written on my board for my patients to telesite, because one of the things I think that gets a bad rep is the idea of hope, right? I know many of my oncology colleagues are very frightened of giving patients false hope. I can understand of not wanting to give patients a false hope that they will be cured, for instance. But the ability to be able to maintain hope that a person can create a future in which their life has some meaning, right? In which they're able to retain some elements of the essence of who they are so that life is worthwhile, worth living while you're going through the treatment. Sometimes I actually say this to the patient. I said, they talk to me about fear of dying and this and that. And I actually say, and nobody's laughed in my face and told me I'm crazy, no patient. I said to him, you've got a bigger problem than dying. I said, your problem is how to live until you die. That's the
How to
real.
live until you die.
How
Yes.
do how you get the problem? How do you live? You're alive. You may die from this. You may die in 3 months. You may die in a year. You may die in 5 years. You may die in 10 years. But in the meantime, you got the problem of how do you live? How do you live in the face of this illness with the treatments that you have to go through? And so you have a bigger problem than dying. Dying will take care of itself. You don't have to do a lot. You may want to prepare, right? You may want to have you want to make sure that you have as meaningful a death or as good, the kind of death that is consistent with who you are as a person and how you live your life. But your big problem is how do I live until that moment? So your problem is how do I live until I die if, in the moment? And so that's the real challenge for most patients. And I think that's really what oncologists are engaged in. Oncologists are engaged in working with patients while they're alive, right, with cancer, and helping them to have the best quality of life, to help their put their cancer into remission, to control it, to eliminate it if possible.
That is a wonderful shift in approach, because as oncologists, we feel oftentimes, I don't want to say put upon, I mean, it's our responsibility that we take up, willingly, that we are providing treatments, and the Holy Grail, of course, is survival, but also quality of life, and we enhance that through our treatments, and we can lose sight of the living that has to go on during the time someone's getting treatment. And sometimes reminding people, like you said, of actually, death will take care of itself. I mean, everyone knows that, but actually to be reminded of that can sort of jar people into, people forget to live. People forget that that is really what it is about, because they get really kind of attached and sort of fixated on, on the treatment, on these things that ultimately they don't have too much control over, and it causes a tremendous amount of distress. I just want to say for the podcast, though, the quote that's on the board, which is so key, is hope is the courage to create an uncertain future. And so
That's
living with uncertainty,
an aphorism by Bill Breitbart, not
an
Nietzsche.
aphorism by Bill Breitbart. And everyone identifies with that uncertainty. And so they strive to get certainty. The interesting thing is, in this patient that I was describing, it's not uncommon. I think Bill will agree with me with this, that you see someone for whom maybe there's been a tremendous amount of uncertainty. Now the cancer's progressed, or now they've stopped treatment. So it's the thing that they've wanted to run away from for so long, and then it finally happens. There can almost be this sense of relief, and I was going to actually follow up on this kind of patient that I
But can I
scenario.
add a
Yeah,
few more
please.
things? I think when patients are dealing with this uncertain future and making choices to create this future, it's really helpful. That's why it's so important for oncologists to work with patients, to be partner with patients around the choices in their treatment and their care, because what really is taking place for patients in this process of creating this future, how they want to live. How do you want to live with cancer? Most patients want to live a longer life, a long life. They want to live a life of quality of life, with some prolonged periods of health, right? So they're going to be they're going to be given choices, right, of treatments, right? And so it's really helpful for the oncologist to partner with the patient in helping them make these choices, because those are the choices that are going to help them create a future. What kind of future do you want, right? And so I think that's a part of the process of creating this future.
It's interesting because one thing I've been thinking as you were talking was about the way that oncologists make decisions around treatments and whatnot. And some of them are very clear. The data suggests this, or this is first-line treatment, et cetera. Many times, especially for kind of orphan diseases, the treatments aren't clear. And so, that often creates such distress in the patients, and it also, I think, comes up in the sense that, like in thinking about this kind of scenario, when someone, you as the oncologist, sort of interacting with your patient for whom you've chosen a treatment, when that choice, has some ambiguity around it, it's very natural to have a sense of guilt or regret, or I could have done this, or this could have happened in a different
Yes.
way. And how those are obviously our feelings, not the patient's feelings. And that is often, I think, what makes some of these end-of-life conversations difficult for oncologists. I think it's much less difficult when the treatment was very clear. This was, and now it's also more clear about the path forward. Anyway, maybe, I don't know, maybe say something about how
Well,
oncologists handle those emotions. Yeah,
yeah.
exactly.
Well, I want to talk about emotions related to
You want
fear
to
for a
say, okay.
second. Yeah,
Good.
I mean, what happens is, I think every what happens is death. The primary emotion that we end up seeing as psychiatrists or as a psychologist or as oncologists, we tend to see fear, right? And fear takes up all the oxygen in the room, and we think that fear is the only emotion of death. Related to death. And emotions and the whole idea of death and the whole idea of the emotions related to death are much more complex than we even think. When we're talking about death, We're talking about not just, we're talking about the period of time that leads up to death. How will I die? Will I be in pain? Will I do that? It's the process leading to dying and needing some reassurance that that can be controlled. And I could still, our jobs as human beings is to try to, at some point in our lives, when we become aware of our existence, to create a life and to create a who in the world, to become a person. And at some point, you learn who you are. And then your job is in a world in which you are battered by hundreds and thousands of external events and elections and economies and pandemics and things like that, and internal events like illnesses and cancers and things like that, to try to preserve the essence of who you are despite being battered in all these directions. And so your job is to try to sustain and preserve the essence of who you are. You can put up with losing some parts of it if you can, accentuate others, right? But at some point, if you completely lose who you are, then that's when people express to you the sense of like it doesn't feel worthwhile existing, right? And so, as much as possible, to help patients preserve, and that's part of what where meaning-centered psychotherapy is all about, is trying to help patients sustain that sense of meaning that life is still meaningful and worth living through utilizing these sources of meaning. But people are concerned about the process of dying and that taking away the chunks of who they are. People are afraid of the actual moment of dying. Will I die in pain? Will I be struggling for air? Will it be painful to die? And then people are concerned about existence. Will I cease to exist? Will I not cease to exist? So dying is actually more complex than just one thing. Death is not just one thing, it's nothing. I try to reassure my patients. I said, while you're thinking of contemplating about answering which one of those areas you're concerned about, let me just say I'm concerned about all of them. Just to
Well,
normalize it.
I love the way you put it, that the fear takes up all the oxygen in the
Well, what
room.
happens also is that the fear ends up taking up all the oxygen. So all you see is fear, and that doesn't allow you. And fear is like, because we're human animals and we have these brains that have these ancient air primitive areas in our brain, the locus coeruleus is like a burglar alarm. When we were cavemen and women, woke you up in the middle of the night when the woolly mammoth was trying to break in the cave, it caused you to run, fear, run, fight or flight response, right? So biologically, we're engineered to be frightened. It's almost like you can't. It's normal. It's built in. It's physiological. It's like your heart rate going up. You can control your heart rate with drugs or meditation or something like that, and we can control fight or flight with medications or meditation, things like that. But there are so many other emotions connected with death or dying, or the idea of being mortal, right? And mortality, your pending mor your mortality, and the possibility of death being closer than it was farther away. That include things like anger, sadness, shame, guilt, all the things that we as oncologists might feel too, in a patient who maybe we felt we couldn't save for some reason, or we feel the responsibility, but maybe I could have done something more. We've got a lot of emotions about it, but patients have m many, many emotions about the concept of dying, and they're concerned about many aspects of dying, many, many aspects of dying.
Well, I like it too.
I actually like to talk about the sadness and the of the dying, because that's really appropriate. When someone's lived a life that's been very meaningful and it's full of connections with love and this and that, it's sad. And patients have concerns about the people they love and how they'll do. They're often people they're worried about. How will they do with I'm not around to help take care of them? Will they be able to take care of themselves? Is there somebody around to take care of themselves? There's this concept of existential guilt, right? The idea, did I do enough? Which your oncologist might experience. existentially, we're meant to live lives to our fullest potential and to achieve the most that we were potentially capable of achieving. A good example of existential guilt is I didn't do enough is Albert Einstein's last words on his deathbed. If only I knew more mathematics. The theory of relativity was not good enough for him. He wanted to develop the theory of everything. And if he knew more mathematics, which was actually re a realistic concern, he did not know enough mathematics. And he learned that while presenting the theory of relativity at a symposium, and a mathematician came up to him and said, "Professor Einstein, you made a mathematical error." And they went in the back to correct it, and it resulted in the second theory of relativity. But anyway, if he just didn't do enough. And we all feel like we didn't do enough. Can you imagine a 40, 45-year-old man, woman with small children, 8, 9, 10? The amount of existential, the things that are undone. I did not raise my children to the age where they could be launched. I did not fulfill my responsibilities as a parent. I did not achieve my goals in my career or becoming who I wanted to be in the world, this and that. The amount of existential guilt is enormous. And existential guilt is often experienced for oncologists, for patients, as shame, as depression, as anger, things like that. When I
And
see
you're
an
saying,
angry young man, I think existential. When I a young younger man, I think a patient, I go think existential guilt. What didn't they do that they feel that? And ultimately, the way to deal with existential guilt is to forgive, is forgiveness, to be able to forgive yourself for merely being an imperfect mortal human being. We're talking both patients and the
and the
oncologist.
oncologist, that's right.
You're an imperfect human being. You cannot control everything. The Stoics had it right when they said, try to control the things you can't control. Don't worry about the things you can't. Focus on the things you can't control. But forgiveness is incredibly important, not just for patients to be able to forgive themselves, but for oncologists to be able to forgive themselves in areas where they feel they could have done more, they didn't do enough. Forgiveness is really interesting in the sense that the same philosopher, Jacques Derrida, paradoxically said, the only thing that you can forgive is something unforgivable.
Yeah.
So if it's
The
forgivable
other
and
ones are easy. The other ones are
yeah,
easy,
if it's
actually, right?
forgivable, then it's easy. But to forgive something, you can only really forgive something unforgivable. So it has to be kind of, forgivable. And for forgiveness requires a degree of love, of self-love. And we're all really pretty, I'm pretty bad at that. And I'm sure a lot of us are pretty bad at that. I don't, I had a very loving family, loving parents, and all that. But even with that, do I deserve it? I know that I can, if I love someone unconditionally, like I love my son Sam. Hi, Sam. I could forgive him anything, anything. The question is being able to love oneself, and that's sometimes for us a real challenge in terms of helping patients find the self-love,
Right, and
and I.
that's the key, is like being able to forgive yourself and sort of modeling that, not taking all the oxygen out of the room by jumping onto that fear, it can be extremely powerful. The other thing I love about what you were saying, Bill, is that, this is I think one of the things that's so hard about this is that there's not a chance to reassure someone, right? I mean, that truly would be false and inappropriate in a lot of ways. But I think that the tool that you're really identifying is about, looking beyond the fear and looking at, this is a person with hopes and dreams and connections and that sort of thing. And you often we may ask, well, what exactly is it that you're afraid of? Hoping that it's something easily remediable. But it may be this larger sort of thing. And again, it's just kind of being seen, being heard, and sharing in that, Yeah. human experience.
And surveys done by Karen Beinhauser, who I think is down at Duke, she showed that what patients really want is a doctor who knows them as a person, who cares about them as a person, a doctor who's willing to share their fears and concerns with them. That's what they want. I mean, she showed this about 2 decades ago now, or 15 years ago, but they want that. And the idea of false hope is a boogeyman that I think really limits a lot of conversations. I think it's very helpful. I mean, if you think about growing up, and all, my son wanted to be an NBA basketball player, right? After he wanted to be a fireman and a policeman, and he wanted to be an NBA basketball player, and I said to him, there are not a lot of like 6 foot tall Jewish basketball players in the NBA, Sam. It's just, and he did not become an NBA. Most of our hopes and dreams, most, don't come true. They were false. They were hopes that were false hopes. They were,
That's a great point.
but they gave direction to your, they gave direction to where you were hoping to move, right? I sometimes call them good lies. I don't think it was Jacques Derrida, but it might have been. I think Jacques Derrida said, the truth is the past. What happened? The truth is the past. What happened? Lies are the future. Lies give shape to what your hopes are, right? And I'm not advocating that people, oncologists, lie to their patients and say, don't worry, this is curable, this and that, all of that. But to be able to say, this is an effective treatment, it's helped so many people. We can work on this. This has a really good chance of helping you. We're going to try to do, but set out what we both hope to set out, which is to create a longer, healthier future for you.
Yeah, and it seems to me, because I find this is something that oncologists also struggle with, that we need to make sure the patient understands the truth, and maybe it's the intent of the treatment, et cetera, but do we need to make sure they understand the 5-year survival curves, et cetera, et cetera?
Right.
And I remember this wonderful paper about collusion, that we may be colluding with our patients when they're expressing these hopes, and how uncomfortable that might be, because you're sort of wondering, like, wait, do they really think that that's going to happen? Is that realistic, et cetera? And you're basically saying that these so-called lies, or these things that sort of populate our view of the world, have a purpose, and that you may go along with them to a certain degree and a certain point. That's
Right.
the collusion.
They're a very famous pioneer in the field of psycho-oncology, who actually preceded Jimmy Holland, who we both had the honor and pleasure of working with, who started modern psycho-oncology. There's a fellow named Avery Weissman, who, along with Bill Warden, started the Omega Institute, which is the first. One of the first institutes studying death and dying. Avery was chief of psychiatry, served the SEAL psychiatry service at MGH. And Avery Weissman, who lived to about 103, actually, Avery Weissman coined the term middle knowledge. And what he told us, which was very, that he normalized this notion that patients can operate on two parallel contradictory tracks. One part of their brain is going, I'm going to beat this. I'm not going to die of this metastatic lung cancer. Right? The other part of the brain goes, okay, this is serious stuff. I have to take this chemotherapy. I have to do this. I have to do that. I have to make a will. I have to make sure I have a cemetery plot. I have to prepare the funeral. I want to make sure that if I need to go to hospice, I go to hospice. I got to take care of it. I got to arrange for that. I got to arrange for how to take care of my grandchildren or my wife or my husband. So you have, they're operating on both levels, and it's not crazy, but it allows patients to to incorporate and synthesize all the information that's coming to them in a manageable fashion, right? So that they're not completely overwhelmed. He actually even said that he thought that on his deathbed, there would be this little part of his brain in the back that goes, I may still get out of this, which is not unusual.
Not
So
unusual, yeah.
no, I had a patient in, we ran a group for a mini-center psychotherapy group, and there were two or three patients in the group who had metastatic cancer. One guy had metastatic lung cancer, brain mets. This was before Keytruda and things like that. And he said, I'm not going to die of this. We're talking, we actually did an interesting paper on prognostic awareness. But when it came time for us to talk about what would make a mean, what would be a good or meaningful death, he actually, after saying he wasn't going to die rather than that, he actually described the fact that he had completely worked out his funeral from soup to nuts. He wanted to have a floral, he was a youngish man in his late 40s, early 50s. He was a Led Zeppelin fan. He wanted to have a floral arrangement in the shape of a Fender guitar, and he wanted to have played Stairway to Heaven. And he had his whole funeral set out. But this is a guy who says, I am not dying from this cancer. So you see, he had both. And he came
Look
to
at
the
the
group. He
actions.
came to the group for patients with advanced cancer. So,
This is, the other
it's
thing that
really the
is,
hope for cure that that people get concerned about, right? And Mark Sullivan, a Seattle-based at the Fred Hutch, as a psychiatrist at the Fred Hutch, he wrote a really interesting paper. Once the hope for cure is lost, patients do not become completely hopeless.
No.
The hope for cure, when that is lost, they start having lots of other very important hopes. I hope to die in my own bed. I hope not to die in pain. I hope to live to see this event. I hope to live to that. I hope I am able to do this or that. They have thousands of other hopes that are very important that oncologists can participate in helping them achieve.
I use that
And we can
sometimes.
as psychologists.
Psychiatry. I use that sometimes too, in terms of bringing up past hopes, like you said, or past events, and people really worry about one particular thing. I say, well, if you look back on other things that have happened, was how it happened what you thought it was going to be? Inevitably, of course, it's not. Happens differently. These are wonderful tools. The other thing that you were saying, Bill, about sort of being and sitting with someone who is experiencing sadness in a moment of thinking about those losses, et cetera. Just because this comes up all the time, and I alluded to it in the patient of. Is it depression, or is sadness? You sort of said it was actually kind of the appropriate response, and certainly okay.
No. Clinical depression, the way psychiatrists identify it, is a specific syndrome that has a specific set of a constellation of symptoms, and we call it depression, clinical depression, based on these particular set of syndromes, because it turns out people who have those sets of symptoms in a syndrome respond to a particular medication. And that tends to be associated with certain neurotransmitter disorders. But the emotion of sadness occurs in many settings outside of clinical depression that would respond to an antidepressant. Now, of course, you can psycho-oncologist or oncologist, you can approach things based on specific diagnoses, or you can approach things based on symptom clusters, right? The two ways of approaching it. So I have a patient who's not clinically depressed, but they may be having trouble with sleep, because they're on steroids, they may have trouble because of their appetite. They may have trouble with appetite when losing weight because of chemo. They may be fatigued from radiation or chemotherapy, and they may have intense anxiety about scan results and things like that. So, it's just constantly interesting. They may not have one specific psychiatric syndrome, but I might use psychotropic drugs to treat those various symptoms that fall into this cluster. I might give them some olanzapine for sleep and for anxiety and for appetite. I might give them a stimulant for the fatigue related to chemo and things like that. So there are two ways of approaching it. And yeah, the being depressed about my grandfather died suddenly during a surgery for a colon cancer resection. And I went to visit him just before the resection. And I walked in on him while he was actually having a panic attack. And he was dissociated. And he was looking in the mirror. He's about 85 years old. He's looking in the mirror in his room. And when I came in, and I was at that point, I was a first year psychiatry resident after having done a year of medicine. And he turned to me and he asked me, "Am I alive or am I dead?" And I said, "Grandpa, you're alive." I had to speak to him in Yiddish. "You're alive." He said, "I'm alive." And then we talked about his fear of dying. And he settled down. And then we walked into this adjacent waiting area, a room for patients. And there was this big picture window. And there was this beautiful set of trees and sunlight shining through. And he looked at me and he said, look at that. Look at the sun. Look at the trees. Isn't life beautiful? I'm going to miss that." Right? And that's just one form of how the idea of contemplating one's death and leaving the things that you love about being alive, the people that you love, the connections
Yeah.
that you have,
That's
it's
a
normal to
beautiful
accept.
example, Bill. Thank you for sharing that. I mean, and he was engaging with you, and I think that's part of the difference too,
Oh, you know what
that's
he did? He asked me a question. He asked me, "Have you seen many people die? Is it painful?" And I said to him, at that point, having done an internship at the equivalent of the Bellevue Hospital of the Bronx, Jacoby, I said, "Matter of fact, Grandpa, I've seen about 1,000 people die. And most of the time, death is not too painful. People kind of drift away, and it's not too painful." I didn't focus on, sometimes people die in with dyspnea and this and that, but and I could have said that and said, we can take care of it, we can treat that, right? He ended up dying in the middle under anesthesia, which was a pretty painless way to die.
Yeah, and so, and that, I mean, this was your grandfather, but I mean, those sort of, I think back to being a young oncologist and learning, you learn so much from patients going through this and sort of
We learn an
he,
awful lot from the experiences we have with our family. In the mid-1990s, Kathy Foley ran something called the Project on Death in America through the Open Society Institute. It ran for about 10 years. And I was in the first class of faculty scholars. And we were basically the Project on Death in America was a project which was intended to create the leadership of modern day palliative care. And the faculty scholars were oncologists, primarily oncologists. There were very few psychiatrists. I was the only psychiatrist in that class. Ethicist Dan Salmazi, some people who were in early palliative care. I mean, one of the things that was so important about the Project on Death in America is that it created this about 100 people who then went on to populate and lead all of the programs of palliative care within the country. And during the first retreat of Project on Death in America, another pioneer in our field of psycho-oncology, a woman named Susan Block, who was first chair of psycho-oncology at the Dana-Farber, she asked me to run a group for the faculty scholars to talk about why they wanted to go into palliative care. And
Okay.
I said, because I was the only psychiatrist, she picked me to run the group. And I said to her, in front of the other participants, I said, I don't really think people want to talk about why they chose palliative care as a field. I don't think they want to talk about death and dying. And they all go, oh yeah, we really want to talk about it, Bill. Because I really
Little
wanted,
reverse psychology there, Mitch.
I wanted to get out of it. I wanted to get out of it. Anyway, I wrote a piece for it that appeared in the AMA's learning module thing on palliative care. It's called The Minion, because 10 faculty scholars, everything sacred that occurs in Jewish ritual occurs with t 10 people present, right? So you need a minion before you bury somebody or have some kind of family. And what was dramatic was that every single person in the room, all 10 of us, were drawn into palliative care because of an experience we had with a family member who was dying or had cancer, things like that, animal care. And when I was a resident in psychiatry at Jacoby, I ran a group for oncologists and nurses. And every single person who came to the group had some experience, seminal experience in their in during their lifetime with a close somebody they loved who had an encounter with cancer and this and that, either good or bad, or whatever. And so I think this is a very common element. The most common character, the very interesting epidemiologic study. One of the most common factors that predicts medical students going into psychiatry is having had a depressed mother. Right? It's a very interesting thing. Well, I wrote a paper on this group for oncologists and oncology nurses. Primary factor joining the group and staying in the group is having had a family member do this. So I think there are a lot of us who go into this field of oncology or psycho-oncology because we've had experiences growing up, because we're trying to still work out issues related to how do I feel about death? How do I, how do I detoxify?
And there's nothing wrong with that,
There's
right?
nothing wrong with that at all.
We keep these. Yeah, exactly. That's actually a beautiful thing. It's sort of a sublimation, technical term, right? Wonderful. Well, I have to say that I'm just overjoyed that Bill has been able. This is exactly what I was hoping for.
I'm sorry if I didn't give you a chance to ask all your questions,
No,
Dan.
I th this was great. It was an experience, as it always is, to have Bill. And I think we all got a little glimpse into his wonderful insights. And these are things that I'm just hoping to share,
Yeah, hope it'll help somebody.
I do too.